views and opinions regarding the findings and or devices discussed in this podcast are those of the host, subject matter experts, and or guests. Facts represented constitute our understanding at the time of the podcast, whereas updated factual information may be developed in the future. They should not be construed as pronouncing an official Department of Defense's position, policy, decision, or endorsement. The hosts and guests of Cubist may be defense contract personnel who support the Traumatic Brain Injury Center of Excellence, and their status will be identified during introductions to the podcast. Hi, welcome to Clinical Updates in Brain Injury Science Today, or Cubist, a podcast for healthcare providers about current research on traumatic brain injury, also known as TBI. This program is produced by TBI COE. I'm your host, Donald Marion, a contractor in support of TBI COE. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Keith Stusey, a family practice sports medicine physician and TBI subject matter expert, also a contractor in support of TBI COE. Keith and I will discuss a study entitled Changes in Resting State Functional Connectivity and Cognitive Affective Symptoms in Patients with Post-Concussion Syndrome Treated with N-acetylcysteine by Dr. Daniel Monti and colleagues and published in the Journal of Head Trauma and Rehabilitation in November of 2024. Keith, thanks for bringing this article to our attention. So why was the study done?
Hi, Don, and thanks for having me today. So for our listeners out there, in our past Cubist episodes, it seems like we typically focus on the diagnosis and treatment of acute concussion. But this month, I'm pretty excited because we're actually going to focus on the longer-term sequelae of concussion, and that being post-concussion syndrome, or PCS. So for our listeners, this term is used to characterize individuals who have symptoms that persist for more than several months, typically 3 months post-injury. And these symptoms can vary amongst individuals. Usually they involve a variety of cognitive, physical, emotional, or behavioral complaints. And of note, PCS can occur in up to 30% of adults who have sustained a concussion. So unfortunately, the exact mechanism of PCS is poorly understood. And the authors discuss the foundation for alterations in functional connectivity in the brain that can help to explain the symptoms that are associated with PCS. There are studies out there using advanced MRI techniques that suggest this association. And in addition, they discuss the fact that some studies have suggested that oxidative damage is the potential contributing factor to the development and maintenance of chronic symptoms following a concussion. So there's a growing body of literature that suggests that a concussion can induce oxidative stress in the brain, leading to lipid membrane disruption, mitochondrial dysfunction, and overall cellular dysfunction and damage, resulting in excessive release of neurotransmitters, primarily glutamate. So the specifics of the mechanisms by which this oxidative stress is associated with concussions and ongoing symptoms is still being evaluated, but it really does appear that it plays a potentially important role in patients who have these symptoms. So if you can manage this oxidative stress by using antioxidants that get into the brain, this could prove to be useful as a therapeutic target. So there are a variety of antioxidant options available, but N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, is the only antioxidant known to increase the brain's natural antioxidant glutathione. So NAC has been shown to cross the blood-brain barrier to improve neural function through various pathways. NAC has been used to treat patients with primary progressive multiple sclerosis, and in a double-blind randomized control trial with active duty service members who were deployed to Iraq, oral NAC has been shown to provide symptom reduction in acute mild traumatic brain injury, or MTBI. The NAC group showed significant improvements in symptoms and neuropsychological testing at day 7 after injury as compared to placebo. In addition, there was another trial in acute MTBI similarly showed recovery advantages from administration of NAC soon after the injury. In fact, Don, when I was previously on active duty and getting ready to deploy in 2010 to set up a concussion clinic in Afghanistan, The primary investigator of this first study reached out to me, and we discussed possibly using NAC acutely in theater. But unfortunately, we were never able to implement this treatment algorithm. So this concept of using NAC in concussion has been around for over 15 years. But while these previous few studies have indicated potential clinical effectiveness of NAC in patients with MTBI acutely after the injury, there have been no studies that have evaluated whether patients with chronic PCS would also benefit from NAC administration, with a hypothesis put forward that there is an alteration in functional connectivity in patients with PCS due primarily to this oxidative stress. The authors stated that the purpose of the study was to assess the potential effects of NAC in patients with chronic PCS symptoms and to determine if any such effects might be correlated with changes in brain functional connectivity.
Hey, Keith, remind the listeners what you're talking about with PCS symptoms. What are those symptoms?
It can vary across a wide spectrum. I mean, if we take a look at what people are affected by, they can have physical symptoms such as chronic headaches. Oftentimes, they can have these cognitive effects, which can be issues with memory or concentration. In addition, some behavioral effects, we see anxiety, even depression can happen as they go further out from their concussion. Studies show between maybe 15 and 30% of people can have these, and oftentimes it can be quite debilitating in their daily lives because these symptoms just go on and on.
Yeah, I can imagine that puts a lot of stress on their family and so forth. So thanks for explaining the importance of oxidative stress after TBI. You said that NAC is effective, at least in part, by increasing the natural antioxidant in the brain, which is glutathione. So, Keith, why not just do a study of glutathione?
Well, that's a great question, Don. And it's really my understanding that glutathione can be given both orally and intravenous. However, the oral glutathione is degraded in the gastrointestinal system, and the IV form of glutathione is mostly metabolized by liver enzymes in the blood and has a very short half-life. So if you give either form of this, in essence, hardly any of it is going to cross the blood-brain barrier. And as such, the clinical effects of direct glutathione replacement could not be expected to be neuroprotective. So NAC, on the other hand, is able to cross the blood-brain barrier and is able to diffuse easily into neurons, and thus it's more likely to have that antioxidant effect that is so important for the treatment.
So Keith, how did they do this study?
Well, Don, it's kind of interesting. They had a total of 50 patients that consisted of 21 males whose average age was 42 years old and 29 females whose average age was 49.6 years old. And they were all suffering from chronic post-concussive symptoms that were enrolled in the study. You know, for our audience, which is mainly providers that treat active duty folks, all these subjects were civilian, and they were enrolled through the Thomas Jefferson Hospital System and the surrounding communities in Philadelphia. So their inclusion criteria included a diagnosis of one or more mild TBIs who reported symptoms that lasted for at least 3 months and were consistent with the International Classification of Disease 10 or the ICD-10 criteria for post-concussive syndrome. So subjects were allowed to continue taking medications for their symptoms related to MTBI and were on those medications for at least 1 month prior to enrolling. So on the opposite side, the exclusion criteria included having any structural intracranial abnormalities that would prevent the functional MRI analysis software from performing accurately, and then any pre-existing medical, neurological, or psychological disorder that could reasonably be explained to interfere with the assessment of these post-concussive symptoms. And so, for example, if they had, let's say, major depression prior to having the concussion or a mild TBI, then, of course, trying to assess that after the event would be difficult. So those folks were excluded. So in addition, NAC is known to worsen asthma. So a history of moderate to severe asthma was included as part of their exclusion criteria. So these 50 PCS subjects that qualified for the study underwent an initial resting state functional connectivity, magnetic resonance imaging, and neuropsychological assessment using a variety of surveys to evaluate general post-concussive symptoms, anxiety, depression, sleep, and cognition. And so after this initial testing, participants were divided into two groups. One group included 25 patients who received 3 months of NAC. The other group included 25 patients assigned to a waitlist control group without the NAC intervention. So the intervention included a combination of both intravenous, which was 50 milligrams per kilogram, one time each week for 3 months, and oral NAC, which was 500 milligrams twice a day on each of the other 6 days per week for a total of 3 months. So it has been shown that oral NAC alone does not increase the blood-brain levels of glutathione, so that's why the IV was included. And several previous neuroimaging studies have shown that IV NAC does increase glutathione in the brain, and they allowed patients to maintain their current level of PCS care and added the NAC administration to their ongoing treatment. Now, this waitlist control group received standard of care management for their PCS symptoms for the initial 3 months. And then once that 3 months was up, they were offered the opportunity to receive the oral plus IV NAC for a subsequent 3 month period.
Keith, you mentioned several times standard PCS care over a 3 month study period. Was that PCS care from a single provider? And if so, was it standardized?
Yeah, great question, Don. And the answer is no, it wasn't. So the author specifically stated that the subjects continued to receive the care they had been getting, but it appears there were multiple providers involved. And as I mentioned earlier, this was done through the Thomas Jefferson System of Care. So there were probably multiple neurologists, multiple other providers that were taking care of these people. So indeed, it was not standardized.
Okay, so can you tell me a little bit about how they did their statistical analysis and what were the initial demographic results that they found?
Great question, Don. So to estimate the distribution of gender and age within and between patient groups of the controls and the NAC group, a chi-square and two sample t-tests were employed. Now, to explore the pattern of group differences in functional connectivity, they used statistical software to analyze and identify significant clusters, which were then selected as regions of interest. And there are several different statistical methods that were used to evaluate the association between the changes in this functional connectivity measurement and the regions of interest and the neuropsychological test scores while adjusting the effect for age and group. A p-value of less than 0.05 was considered a significant level in all analysis. So to your original question regarding the demographic results, there were no significant differences between the age of patients in the controls and the NAC group, and no significant difference in the distribution of males and females in each group. There was no significant difference in injury to imaging interval, although there was a wide range between 24 and 37 weeks. And the control group had 9 patients with a single concussion and 16 patients with multiple concussions, while the NAC group had 8 patients with a single concussion and 17 patients with multiple concussions.
So it's good that there was no statistical significance between the groups, and that adds legitimacy to the study, I guess. Keith, the authors describe in detail their analysis of the functional MRI group by time interactions of the regions of interest. While that may be of interest to some of our listeners, for time's sake in this podcast, can you just give us a brief synopsis of the imaging results and how they correlate with the neuropsychological testing?
Yeah, Don, you really are correct in saying they went into great detail regarding these regions of interest. As you mentioned earlier, I'm a primary care sports med doc, and you know, imaging is not my forte. But you know, for those listeners, I would encourage them to go read the article if they want more detail about the specifics of this methodology. But I'm going to do my best to kind of, you know, simplify what happened. So regarding the broader synopsis of the results, I'm going to start by saying that the treatment arm with NAC demonstrated positive clinical effects with neuropsychological correlates on functional MRI, resting state, functional connectivity. So the results showed that there were significant improvements in several subjective symptom measures, including an approximately 20% reduction in anxiety and a 35% improvement in depression. Now, these reductions in depression and anxiety in the NAC-treated PCS patients were associated with underlying changes in functional connectivity, particularly between what's called the salience network and the superior parietal lobe. So in case our listeners aren't aware, the salience network helps you prioritize what you pay attention to. It helps to manage your emotions and really guide your behavior. While in the superior parietal lobe, on the other hand, helps to direct actions based on stimuli identified as important by this salience network. So the way I understand it is that there's an overactivation between the salience network and superior parietal lobe that can really heighten sensitivity to emotional cues and lead to difficulties in emotional regulation, thus exacerbating both anxiety and depressive symptoms. What's really interesting is the current study suggests that the NAC might reduce this functional connectivity, particularly between the salience network and the superior parietal lobe, so which would then reduce anxiety and depression. So the correlations are really nice, and this antioxidant effect seems to be real. So in addition, this study found that there were global changes in functional connectivity observed within critical brain networks, such as the salience network, the dorsal attention network, the executive control network, and all these areas, indicating that the treatment may have had general effects on many brain areas. The authors comment that such changes might account for some of the clinical improvements noted, and in particular, there was a 23% improvement in the total River Mead Concussion Questionnaire score, which incorporates a variety of cognitive, emotional, and sensory symptoms. There have been other studies that have shown an increase in functional connectivity between the various regions of the brain, such as the temporal pole, the superior temporal gyrus, the temporal lobe, and the posterior cingulate cortex in patients who have chronic MTBI 1 year after their injury. The changes in functional connectivity observed in the present study were generally reduced, which is consistent with other studies that have demonstrated this overactive connectivity in the brain that is associated with ongoing symptoms. Thus, it is possible that the NAC improves symptoms by facilitating reduction in the heightened functional connectivity observed at baseline. So because functional connectivity changes have been observed in patients with PCS in many of these brain regions and networks, measuring changes in functional connectivity has the potential to serve as an objective biomarker for PCS prognosis and response to therapy as described in study. And as you know, Don, we're always looking for objective biomarkers to take a look at how people are affected by concussions.
So that I'm clear on what you're saying, post-concussive symptoms appear to be related to hyperactivity of some of these networks, and NAC may be effective because it lowers that hyperactivity, thereby reducing the post-concussive symptoms. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's a great summary. And so if you even go further and say, well, why does that occur? Well, these hyperactive functional connectivities, let's call them, may be due to this oxidative stress. So if you get the oxidative stress after the concussion, this leads to this hyperactive functional connectivity, which results in these symptoms. So getting that NAC inside the brain can lower the oxidative stress and therefore potentially would lower the symptomatology.
So the results are really interesting. And it's great that these investigators looked at this novel approach to treatment for patients who suffer from chronic symptoms associated with concussion that can really mess up your quality of life. However, there are always limitations with these research studies. So can you point to some of those, Keith?
So while the NAC and the control groups were not significantly different in terms of symptoms or severity, we know that there are always multiple factors related to how people respond to concussion. As we've talked about many times on this podcast, there are issues with any study involving treatment of MTBI. In addition, both groups had nearly twice as many individuals with multiple concussion versus a single concussion. And I just really want to point that out, that I think it's really difficult to make any conclusions given the heterogeneity of these individuals. And really, in a perfect world, I think they should have studied only individuals with a single concussion so that they were more conclusive in their results. And while the authors did a thorough screening of patients, it's possible that these patients did not report prior confounding conditions such as headaches, anxiety, or depression. And I didn't mention it previously, but the authors did identify three patients who met the criteria for major depression only after their concussion and associated with their post-concussive symptoms. So they ended up performing a separate analysis excluding these three patients, which showed essentially the same results. And they felt that this confirms that the major depression in these few subjects did not alter the findings of the imaging data. And perhaps most importantly, this was not a blinded or placebo-controlled study. The author specifically commented that the automated nature of the image analysis removed some of the investigator bias in terms of the results obtained, especially when you're looking at these images in great detail. And since the patients in the NAC group had IV therapy infusions that were not matched for time and treatment duration with the control group, this is really a major confounder. And it will be essential for future studies to use a placebo-controlled condition for comparison. The authors reiterated the need for the use of IV NAC, as I previously discussed, and the importance of increasing glutathione levels achieved by the use of IV NAC. This regimen that was utilized in the study are consistent with previous IV NAC regimens used for treatment of Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis, which also showed positive effects on both neuropsychological and clinical outcomes. But it's certainly not known if this exact protocol using the IV and the oral NAC is really specific to this population who have had mild TBI.
Thanks, Keith. So a lot of information, but what are the key takeaways for primary care providers in the military?
So, Don, I'm really excited to present this study on our podcast because it really gives some hope for those patients who are suffering from these chronic symptoms associated with concussion. And this study showed that patients treated with NAC appear to have had significant improvements in certain reported PCS symptoms that correlate with underlying neuropsychological changes in functional connectivity with NAC administration. And while I'm certainly not recommending that our providers go tomorrow and start treating everyone that has PCS with NAC, I do think it is the first step and an important advancement toward treating individuals who suffer from chronic symptoms post-concussion. NAC is generally considered safe to use and has a fairly low side effect profile, but certainly more research will be needed regarding the optimal dosing for this subset of individuals who suffer from PCS and perhaps development of an oral-only dosing regimen, as this would be much easier to take.
You know, I agree. This is a very exciting look at a potential pharmacologic treatment for our service members who suffer from chronic symptoms associated with concussion. And, you know, I would point out, we don't really have any great pharmacologic options at this point for chronic post-concussive syndrome. So this is important. I would also like to see a study in those with PCS for only 3 to 6 months. And as you said, only one concussion rather than multiple concussions. Also, I think the age range of 42 to 50 years for this cohort was older than most active duty military, though it could be more relevant for veterans experiencing ongoing PCS symptoms. Thanks for your commentary. That's all we have time for today. You can stay up to date on future episodes of Cubist by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts, where you can also find links to the articles we discuss and other relevant resources. Cubist is produced and edited by Vinnie White and was hosted today by me, Don Marion. It is a product of the Traumatic Brain Injury Center of Excellence, a branch of the Research Portfolio Management Division under the Research and Engineering Directorate of the Defense Health Agency, and is led by Branch Chief Dr. Katie Stout. Thank you for listening to this episode.